And so I was great and accomplished much more than all of Jerusalem living before. Much more than this city that I could define, yet all of my wisdom, in fact, remained mine. That was Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 9, from the version of Yours Truly from 2020. That's our daily scripture for today, little children, and continuing our study of the article entitled The Ark of Urartu, which is also Noah's Ark, as we've identified it, and the testimony. Now, from paragraph 8 of chapter 1, the testimony from Mr. Forster's book. That's the book Israel in the Wilderness, 1865, page 201. He writes, "It is astonishing how few men know when a point is proved. That is a very, very astute observation." Astute meaning accurate, but also astute meaning requiring intelligence of quite a high level. The point of, in other words, you have to be quite intelligent to make an observation like that, to notice how few men know when a point is proved. See, many people will find the proof of something and then they'll continue to try to prove it. And they'll continue until they find something that disproves what they've already proven, instead of accepting the proof. And that's what can happen with something like the Ark. That's why many people, even people such as Mr. Fassold, for example, believed for a long period of time. He believed in the Ark, and then he stopped believing, and then he believed again, and so on. Believed that it was Noah's Ark, and then, you know, had his doubts along the way, of course. But that's because there are many other opinions to which we may become susceptible if we expose ourselves to them by continuing to try to look for a proof anywhere. We can't look for proof just anywhere. I'd love to explain some more things about this. It's also true of many things in the world when we're shopping for things, too, where we're trying to find out or prove to ourselves that a product is good enough for us to buy. It works. It's true in those cases too, that there are certain techniques that work where we narrow down our focus rather than trying to look for proof from anywhere or, you know, find the right product according to different sources. Right, it's better if we narrow our focus, and one way to do that is to be focused on the standard itself, like what size of whatever it is. If it's threads on a faucet, what size threads is it? Focus on those sorts of things, but the problem is you often can't find what you're looking for. Like, they'll sell a product and they won't tell you what the size is. And you'll have to read perhaps all the reviews by other people and see what they used it for and find out from the product reviews whether it's a product that can do what you want it to do. But even as an engineer like I am, I find it extremely difficult to build or design something and then shop for parts to build it. Just very difficult to get the information that's sufficient information, I guess is what I want to say, to get sufficient information to be absolutely certain that it's going to work to do what I want it to do, or that the parts will fit together. Because, I mean, parts can be incompatible. And that could, you don't want to buy something if you have any doubt that it's going to fit, because that's a waste of time and money, potentially. Right? But now, the point of validation is not that of the Ark itself, but of the Bible. Okay, that's an important thing, too, yeah. So it's not just, really, it's not the ark at all that we're trying to prove. It's the Bible. And that becomes, or is seen as, more of a test of religion. It's simply that the ark confirms the Bible. That's true. If we confirm it is the ark, then the Bible must be true also. We say this on the understanding that no little scientific studies, scientific testing, and or scientific analysis have already been done on the petrified remains themselves. And still, a lot of work remains to be done on this same topic. There are essentially two main points here as one sees it. The first is that we all descended from Noah, according to the Bible, and finding Noah's Ark is a great ancestral key to the past, through which we may learn about Noah, family members with him, and even about people before the deluge. I mean, the allergies today in the house are not as bad. I think I was running my filters on a very low setting, and that's they weren't filtering fast enough yesterday, but the air quality was incredibly bad in the house for a while, and it was even worse than it was outside for quite a while. That can happen too during allergy season, but it's the ragweed right now that's so bad that affects me sometimes by runny nose or itchy eyes, and sometimes by a tickle in the throat that, you know, many different things can be problems with these allergies, especially this hay fever or ragweed. Ragweed is the particular problem that begins about August 20th or so every year. So this Noah's Ark is a great ancestral key to the past through which we may learn about Noah, family members with him, and even about people before the deluge. That's incredible, because if we can see how the ark was built. I mean, I just want to rush and speak very quickly, but I should really slow down and speak more slowly. But, you know, the ark, by looking at the way it's built, we can learn about how people were or what the technology was before the deluge, which tells us a lot about the people living before the deluge. For example, the fact that the rivets contained titanium. That is incredible. Unbelievable, almost. But yet, it suggests that the metalworking before the deluge, and in the Bible, mentioned perhaps only with regard to the one metalworker mentioned who was Tubal-Cain, must have been very advanced before the deluge, or evidently was advanced. And so that's why after the deluge it went back to square one again, which we call the Bronze Age. Descending from Noah's wife, because all humans descended from that one woman, Noah's wife, all humans alive today, according to the Bible. I say, God bless my mother. On the other hand, I do not know if I descend from Nimrod. Nimrod was a later descendant of one of Noah's sons, Ham, right? Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Nimrod was a descendant of Ham. And I don't know if I descend from Nimrod through some intermarriage. Once again, we may view it as a confirmation of the Bible, but view what as a confirmation of the Bible? That's the question. Yeah, the Ark. That's what we're viewing as a potential confirmation of the Bible. If we believe it is, if we believe we found Noah's Ark, which, I mean, each one can say that for themselves, then it confirms the Bible. But does the Ark correspond to the dimensions given there? So here we have a couple of things. We can click on this Bible Hub link here. You see how the New International Version says the same thing as most translations: 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high, which we've been discussing. But you see, when they have the cubit defined as 18 inches, which is wrong, Then they say the boat is 450 feet long instead of 515 feet long. So all the other dimensions are wrong too, because they had the cubit wrong. And okay, but if we just look at some of the others, the English Standard Version, the length of the ark, 300. The Berean, length of the ark, 300. King James, 300. New American, 300 cubits. So as long as we define the cubit, then, according to the Egyptian royal cubit, we get the 515 feet that we see and observe on the relic of Noah's Ark today. And returning also to this, to the that link for the Brenton doesn't work, but we can get Brenton's online translation right here at ebible.org. E-Bible being one word, and we see that in Genesis 6 and 17 and 18, or 16 and 17, excuse me, 16 and 17, it says that there would be a door on the side of the ark and a lower second and third story, so that there is, it's a three-story vessel, according to the Bible. We don't need to give any more information than that. Let's go back to the article. So, you know, we studied the dimensions. We came up with the results that it really is the correct dimensions, and even the number phi, 1.618033988875, I think that's phi to a certain number of decimal places, but it's a repeating, it's non-repeating, it's an infinite irrational number, phi, non-repeating decimal that never repeats, but it is pretty accurate with say, you know, 10 decimal places or whatever, that 12 significant figures, whatever it is that we gave, and we saw that the number phi was involved in the construction of the ark, and that the dimension of the width of the ark was given as an average width, which when you multiply by phi, you get the exact maximum beam width of the ark relic located on Mount Judy today that was seen right near Uzengili and found at some length, originally found in 1958 or 59 by the Turkish military aerial photo, but then investigated in the 70s by Ron Wyatt and many other people. Also visited the site, including, I believe, astronauts and people who were interested. Many people have been there to the Drupanar site, as it is named, after the Turkish military officer who discovered it. So it's a beautiful photo, and we can see it. Here's the shape of it right here. This beautiful boat-like shape as seen from the sky. That's it for today's study of the article. Unless we have a little extra time, which we might use to come back to it. But I need to find out now. Just realized I haven't confirmed exactly where we're going to be starting our video today. Let's see, let's go to the end of that video that we saw yesterday. Where is it? 39, looks like 31, okay. About 39, 31. That's where we want to begin the video. If Jehovah's willing and the video is still available, we'll have to see. Let's maximize it. I'm not signed in. I don't log into any sites, or I don't register for anything if I can avoid it. Try to avoid registration. It's just overly complex. 39-10, I think I said. 39 minutes. Okay. See what it's like.
Tiki, and then dived under it to reappear on the other side. It was so large that when its head re-emerged on one side of the raft, its tail was still visible on the other side. It continued swimming round and under the raft, and naturally we were not a little concerned as to how this visit would end. We had no firearms, only a few hand harpoons and a fish spear. Tension proved too much for Hesselberg. It looked as if the whale shark intended to follow us all the way across. And as it once again approached the Kon-Tiki, he plunged the fish spear into its sinewy head. For a split second, all was chaos, after which the great monster reared up and slithered down into the deep. The harpoon line snapped, the harpoon broke, and the shaft floated up a few yards further on. In the course of a few seconds, the whale shark never repeated its visit. As the days passed, there was plenty to record in our log. Haugland amused himself using ink from a cuttlefish to write with. Small cuttlefish would arrive on their own on deck practically every night. When cut open, they provided an inkwell ready for use. The ink, too, was of good quality, almost like Indian ink used by artists. On dark nights, giant cuttlefish, squid, measuring some 3 to 4 meters in length, would appear on the surface of the sea with their phosphorescent eyes, but they never invaded the raft. Finally, one day, we had visible proof that we were approaching land on the other side of the ocean. The first frigate bird from Polynesia came flying towards us. We realized how important it now was to keep a sharp lookout. We were drifting towards the dangerous coral shoals in the Tuamotu group of islands. They are notorious on account of the seemingly endless coral reefs with which they are surrounded, while the islands themselves are so low that they are only seen when one is hurled ashore through surf pounding on coral reef. After being at sea for 93 days, the lookout climbed the mast one morning and announced that he could see land, a low palm-clad South Sea island. We celebrated our arrival in Polynesia by hoisting all our flags and working the helm for all we were worth. But wind and current were too strong for us to alter course. Despite all our efforts, we continued to drift in the same direction, and the island was soon out of sight, astern. Four days later, we were approaching another South Sea island further west and spent the whole day outside the reef trying hard to find a way through. We were in fact so close to the shore that natives on the beach caught sight of the Kon-Tiki and paddled out in a canoe to welcome us. This meant that we had made contact with our first Polynesians. Our new native friends, each one armed with a paddle, joined us in our struggle against our long-termed former allies, wind and current, who were determined to push us further west. We realized now that the overriding factor was not distance, but direction. We had drifted automatically a fifth of the way round the globe in a westerly direction. But working our way a mere 200 or 300 yards in the opposite direction proved impossible. We were so close to land that Haugland even managed to paddle ashore in the Rabidinghi and was very nearly compelled to remain behind with the natives. Once again, we drifted across the ocean. Our visitors departed and returned in their canoes, and the six of us were left behind on our unruly logs. After 101 days, we sighted land for the third time. This time we were confronted with a veritable bastion of palm-fringed islands and reefs stretching ahead as far as the eye could see from north to south. We put the helm hard over in an attempt to approach from the rear as the surf was breaking directly on the side to which we were drifting. If only we could circle the entire coral reef, We might be able to land on the other side in the lee of the surf.
Beautiful. So that's a great example, isn't it? Showing us that it's very easy to be close to your goal and yet not be able to achieve it. And nature is very powerful, right? And so this is a great illustration, isn't it? I mean, because it shows in the same way we might be an engineer or somebody who's just a regular consumer, but who's trying to design, you know, a system for their house, trying to get their system, maybe their heating or their water system for their house, you know, or you know, plumbing, I mean, or something, working in their house, and they're trying to buy the parts for it and so on, and they can see how close that they're very close, in fact, to achieving their goal, but they can't reach it for some reason. Just like in this case that we saw in the movie there, they were very close to the islands, but they were on a boat that was driven by the wind, and whose course, or the course of which was entirely determined, or almost entirely determined by that wind and the currents, and had nothing to do with their steering. They could do very little. And it's a wonderful, wonderful illustration, isn't it, for life, where we often can't control our steering either, not to a great degree. So we can see we're being driven along by this mainstream current, or something that we can see. And I see that it's true of many religions, for example, even Christian religions, that they're being driven by this mainstream current, and they're having trouble becoming united with the true Christian faith through Jesus and the creation belief, the belief in the creation rather than in the popular evolutionary theories and all of that, which are just theories and they don't have any real basis in reality at all. Not like the creation does. Like, we know the creation is based on reality because we see the creation in front of us. So we know that's real, you know, or is real. And then there are of course, people who even deny the creation is real. But for anyone who accepts that the creation is reality, you can't deny that it therefore must have been created. And if you believe that it didn't exist forever, and many scientists do believe that creation came into existence at some point. So therefore, how did it come into existence? Logically, you can argue there needed to be a creator, but of course that's human wisdom that's telling us that. So, you know, you can't prove God's existence. It's a faith issue, of course. And creation, similarly, is a faith issue, really. But Noah's Ark, we've been studying it, and we've got a lot more time today, but I think I wanted to study or talk about maybe some more about shopping today in the time that we have left. I mean, you can go online. Like, when I bought my boots, I wanted to talk more about the boots that I bought because they were just astonishing. And, I mean, it's almost true of everything else, too. Like, you can buy very expensive things that solve a problem, or you can get very inexpensive solutions that solve the same problem. And very often the average consumer doesn't really understand the difference or how to find the cheaper or the easier, you know, the less expensive solution. Instead, you buy a more expensive piece of equipment, like a reverse osmosis water purifier or filtration system, right, that purifies the water, but then you have to replace the filters every few weeks in some cases, if you have a very high concentration of impurities in your water. But it's probably more like every few months that you have to replace these filters, and they're not free. So if you buy a very expensive system, you're also buying into this And that's true of many different types of things that you can purchase. The more expensive item you buy, the more you're buying into a whole world or a system that involves replacement parts, and that's the way they're set up. So the more expensive items are designed to need or require replacement parts, whereas the cheaper ones, you may not even have to replace anything. Like in some cases, I can't think of the example, but I know it's true. I remember this having seen. I can't think of the example that applies here. Well, example would be the case I'm thinking of right now. But by the way, my reverse osmosis machine didn't get delivered, so I got that money refunded. So now I get to make a different solution, and I've come up with a different idea. I've already been filtering my water, but I'm trying to think now. What was I? I may not need to do that, or I may not want to use that process of reverse osmosis because of the need to replace all the filters. And the problem I see in that is you need to replace them so often. You know, I mean, you need to replace them not just so often, but you can't buy them and get overnight delivery with most of these filters. If you can't get overnight delivery, then that worries me. And they're not going to be available forever anyway, even if you could get overnight delivery for the filters. So, I mean, anything that's not overnight delivery is a bigger question as to whether you're ever going to get products. So, let's move on to talk about the boots that I bought. I think I want to talk about that. So, they're just remarkable. I needed work boots because my old work boots had outsoles that rotted away completely, and they were both boots that cost, well, I had one pair that was $300, at least something in that order, in that vicinity of that order, of about $300. They were Red Wing, Minnesota. When my wife and I visited, my late wife and I, when we visited Red Wing, Minnesota, we both bought boots or shoes. I think she got shoes, I got boots. I got work boots that were steel toes, and they were $300, and they were beautiful, but they actually weren't a good fit for my foot particularly, and they're clunky, and they were clunky, and they're big, and they're, I mean, heavy, not comfortable particularly at all. So, I mean, they would do the job, but then because the outsole rotted away, I can't replace it without paying. I should be paying more like $100 or $200 or $150 to get a new outsole. So I don't think it's worth it, because you can buy boots for that nowadays because of, you know, all the advances, but not just because of China, but that was always true. You could buy boots for $150. So I bought this. And then I have another pair of boots that was King Tread, I think they're called, and King's Tread or King Tread, but they're both complete, entirely upper leather uppers, made of genuine leather, both pairs of boots, and the King Tread were much lighter boots, but they didn't fit my feet very well. I mean, they were tight. They fit instead of being too loose like the other ones. These were too tight, really, and not enough toe room, so it was pretty hopeless, because they were steel toes, you can't expand the steel toe, hopeless to, and steel toes are just, they're not the best. You can actually have your feet severed, your toes can be severed with steel toes if a heavy enough weight drops on a steel toe, it can sever your toes, so steel toes aren't necessarily the best type of protection. So I don't really want either of those pairs of boots, and so the outsoles rotted on both of them, so they're useless. So I ended up getting these new ones, which are the Nortive 8, And they just look like a regular work boot. And they have uppers that are partially leather. And the fabric part makes them breathe better. And they're beautiful. They're blonde colors, so they're different from my other... I've got Danner boots, which are black, and I have Merrell boots, which are sort of multicolor, the two pairs of boots that I have. And I've got some older running shoes like Spira, which were like $200, and they're beautiful but too small. So I use them for bike riding. And I've got the new Asics that I bought. The Asics running shoes are like $160 at Sport Check. I got them for a good price. For that price, and but they're running shoes, right? They're not really. They're not used. I don't want to use them for anything else other than maybe shopping or, you know, anything like running or activities like that. The Merrells I can use in, you know, for working, but I've got the Danners for working. They're both somewhat leather, but the Danners are completely leather uppers without any steel toe, and neither Merrells nor Danners are waterproof. But the new work boots that I got, see, the Danners and the Merrells don't have a high ankle, so they don't support my ankle. So the new work boots, the Nortive 8, and also the King Tread, which are the two that are no good, the King Tread and the Red Wing, they have high ankles also, but the sole, the out tread, is no good on either of them. So both of them would cost more than $100 to replace that outsole. So I looked at some high boots, and I got these Nortive 8s that have the high ankles. They have a zipper on the side, which is the top quality zipper, which is YKK, the best zippers on the market as far as I can ascertain, which is great. They came with that, plus they have the laces as well, of course, and they have rubber treads. At least it smells like rubber, it seems, and they claim it's rubber, which is better because it shouldn't disintegrate over time. But even if they did, it's only $68 boots. I mean, and they're rated really high. So, I mean, they're rated as high as Merrell's for some of the other boots they sell. I'm not sure about these particular boots, but the ratings on Amazon, there were 20,000 ratings. 20,000 ratings means a lot of people buy them. And the ratings were high. So these Nortive 8 are really good boots for $68. But then I put an insole that costs $65 in them. I just happen to have one lying around, but it was a new one, which I'd never cut to size, so I put it in. But, you know, the insoles can be reused later, even if the boots are no good later. I can reuse the insole because if it doesn't wear out, that is. So $65 insole makes the boot, you know, cost more like $150 instead of $68. But it's worth it to have the insole if you have feet like mine, which are not, you know, they're narrow and they're not, I have a high arch. You know, so if you have flat feet, you may not even need an insole, or if you have wide feet, etc. But it's September 10th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 14:17 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. I feel good today. In fact, thank you for listening and watching. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying. Bye for now. I topped up my supplements. I kind of came to a limit with my supplements.